Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with novelist Kent Wascom, whose amazing new book is Secessia, and photographer Robert Brantley, author of Henry Howard, Louisiana's Architect. Every now and then, a debut novel comes along that makes readers and critics stand up and cheer. Ken Wascom's first book, Blood of Heaven, did just that, winning award nominations and kudos everywhere. Now the Louisiana native is back with his second novel depicting the city of New Orleans during that turbulent year of 1862 under the rule of Benjamin Butler. It's called Secessia, and it should be at the top of your reading list this summer. Kent, welcome to The Reading Life.
Susan, it's great to be here.
And congratulations. What an amazing book this is.
Thank you. It means a lot for you to say.
Now, you started off your writing career with this book set in the wild and crazy West Florida parishes with the Woolsack family. And some of the characters reappear in this book. And you said that you see what you're writing as this long series of books about Southern history.
Yeah, and specifically the history of this stretch of the Gulf Coast, say, from New Orleans to Pensacola and to the Apalachicola River. And now as I'm moving on with the set, what I hope to be a sextet that would go from the Louisiana Purchase to the Deepwater Horizon spill.
Wow.
But now it's kind of spiraling into a bigger and bigger thing. So what I'm working on now, if there's parts that are in Nicaragua and Cuba. So and that's why in Secessia, there's a mention of the Golden Circle, which during the Civil War was this Southern scheme to wrest control of the Caribbean and Central America from the people who had it and establish a slaveholding empire. So I've kind of snatched that term to use, and that's what the sextet's called, the Golden Circle, exploring this imperial impulse.
Oh, the imperial impulse is the root of so much evil,
right,
isn't it? Now, you've come forward in history in this book to 1862, which is a year that's gotten a lot of attention in histories this year as well. But for fiction, it is so rich. So tell us about your sense of that time in New Orleans history.
Well, it's a time of great, great conflict. And it would have been, even without the Civil War, it would have been a time of conflict. It was really the beginning of the next wave of immigration in New Orleans. By 10 years after the Civil War, the French Quarter would be mostly Sicilians and things like that. And all this had just started. And right at this point, it was Irish and German people who were coming in. And when the war began, were thus put into the army. And that's why you have incidents like the Forts Jackson and Philip Mutiny. It was a bunch of German people had moved here and had no particular interest in fighting and dying for this.
Right.
But yeah, there were these deep-seated ethnic conflicts as well, where you had the, what they call the White Caps, the Know-Nothing Party, the nativists. They called themselves Native Americans, but very much white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who wanted to keep control of the government of New Orleans. And a lot of the recent immigrants, this is in 58, I believe, banded together with the old Creole establishment. Mm-hmm. And there was quite a large riot and true street battles, like Les Miserables style, for control of the city government. And those kinds of divisions were still deeply present, especially after the votes to be cast for or against secession, which many people or historians posited that were falsified, quite a few for. I mean, let alone where I live did not vote. They counted the vote. They didn't vote to secede in St. Tammany, which is odd. Last time they weren't particularly conservative. But so it was a divided city already. And then to bring an invading army in, had this microcosm of conflict where everything is about to come to a head.
Yeah.
All these different forces. So that's what fascinated me.
Now, one of the points of view of this novel is that of Benjamin Butler,
yes,
who is an historical figure. So what was it like to build his character in this way?
He was truly fascinating. Anyone who has an interest in the history of the region, especially the New Orleans, will come upon Ben Butler at some stage. And entirely the presentation is really vicious and of a very, very, very reviled person, whether from northern sources or from historically southern sources. You get, at best, Spoon's Butler thieving the silverware from people's houses, and at worst, Butler instituting a policy of rape in the city. And, you know, people like to say, especially when writing about historical figures, that they found a middle ground with them. You know, while I can kind of understand his motivations. And with Butler, I kind of fell in love with his character. I started reading his autobiography, then his letters, and then reading about him. And I just happened to have the luck that he's from Lowell, Massachusetts, and my wife is as well. So I went to the historical archives there and just looked at his taxes and things like that. And then slowly learning about the guy, and he was a nasty, nasty character in many, many ways, but he was a very capable administrator, as occasionally someone with dictatorial tendencies will tend to be. He was incredibly funny and had a hell of a sense of humor. Sorry. And mostly I would say that a lot of it is egregiously overblown. That's what I found.
One of the things you do so well in this book is present him as so beleaguered by the citizenry that there are people just shouting at the window all the time and just outraged by his very presence. So you do kind of see that. And I love it when you give him a moment of respite to read his favorite childhood book.
Robinson Crusoe.
I know. I love that so much. But he has a good vantage point to view the city at that moment, you know. And you're showing a city that is divided, that is conquered, that is, in the eyes of one character, riddled with disease.
Yeah.
And it's a city that's, I love it when you said, we are never free of storms. I thought you loved writing that.
Yeah.
You know what
that
I mean?
That was one that came that, yeah.
It's a little gift. But also, it's a city in which women are very prominent and important. And I wonder if you talk about that conflict, which is so much at the heart of this book. I mean, anytime you have a section of a book called Uterine Fury, Kent, you're going to be asked about this.
No, I forget. Well, women in New Orleans were as anyone in New Orleans was in a unique position, as they are to any time, in a unique position compared to everyone else in the country. But there was still, there's no right to vote. There's interesting property ownership rights that are different and inheritance things, but that's kind of academic. But the things that fascinated me was the idea of women of mixed racial backgrounds being sued or suing their friends for accusing them of having this taint of blackness. Yeah. And this was a thing that you would follow in the newspaper. It was just, you see your friends at this argument that either your husbands fight a duel or you're going to court. Mm-hmm. And people were accusing each other, whatever evidence they had. There's no evidence they could present. But out of all that morass of fear and the aspect of hiding and passing, that's something that fascinated me. Was always directed towards women, or more frequently directed towards women, that this woman was able to move on into the privileged space of whiteness. And it's become a trope, something of a trope in literature. Yeah. And it's something I wanted to work against, the presentation of these sorts of women in novels. Look at this, 10 novels from 1872 to 1900 about a woman like in the novel Elise. Mm-hmm. And they all end with this. They have to end with this tragedy because in their history have strayed from the path
the norms,
of whiteness.
Yeah.
And I wanted to not tell that story. Mm-hmm. And hope that I did.
Well, the women in this book, they're so incredibly full. I mean, they're sexual presences, really. They're very sexual characters. They have, in some ways, the ability to resist what's happening. I think of that chapter of the sewing bee when those women are stitching a Confederate flag.
Yeah.
Jeez, that's the beginning of the Confederate flag thing, you
exactly.
know, which is so amazing. And then you have one character who is a bit of a reader.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you'd tell us about her and read a little passage about her.
The character's name is Marina Fandel, which Fandel's actually a family name of mine, but I came upon her. She's based on a real person, but only one of those, really, speaking of gifts in writing. I was reading through, I believe, Butler's letters. It was an officer's letters from their time on Ship Island, which they used as a transport hub to before the invasion up the river. And the guy reported that one of the United States Navy ships chased a blockade runner from Cuba into a storm, and the ship wrecked, and there was one survivor, and it just had a young girl who spoke German. And the only thing that happened after that I could see in research after that was that she had family in New Orleans, and Major George Strong brought her over under flag of truce to Biloxi, and where, of course, the citizens of Biloxi shot at his ship until he threatened to shell the town. But so they turned her over, and that's it. And I also just kind of stopped. I didn't want to find out more because she came. There she was in my mind. Yeah, and she is a reader. She's in the novel given a copy of a volume of Shakespeare's plays by Benjamin Butler's wife, Sarah Butler, who was an actress when they met. Yeah, so I'll read you her section. The storm is a shear of blackness out of which descends a winged demon. His fingers aim lightning at the frightened faces of the mariners who cling to ropes, to their sinking topmasts, to each other, some looking to heaven and others to the rocks where they will soon be dashed. Upon this outcropping stands the father, dark as the storm he regards. With one hand he clutches to his chest a staff and book of spells, holding in the other the pale upturned palm of his cowering daughter. Dressed in white, her hair crowned with sea lilies and weed pods like the Virgin of Cobre, the daughter kneels at his robes and gapes in horror at the scene. The only darkness she admits is the hash-stroke outline of her figure, so blanched is her person that she fades from the engravings to the blank borders of the page, the foot of which reads, "The Tempest," words themselves obscured by foam and storm cloud. The red leather binding is alive, the gilded filigrees pulse beneath her fingertips. She turns the pages, lingers on a line she favors, Miranda's remembrance of the time before she came to the island, what her father called the dark backward. And so Marina has tried, at the behest of the seemingly endless array of incredulous adults through whose hands she's passed, to render plain the particulars of her past. But she would rather seek her story here in ink, in the company of conjurers, princes, and monsters, of a girl restored to her rightful royal station after a long and torturous exile. In this way, the play has become not only an embellished analog for her past, but also an object for the divination of her future. Still, not all aspects correspond. Her father was not so lucky as Prospero. He did not survive to exhort his daughter's memory, to instruct her on what to make of a castaway existence and life after the storm. She remembers this. Thunder, rain, and wave crash meld, her father drenched so deeply that with every gust of wind his clothes give off a mist of droplets. He shouts her mother's name, but they are so far from the other boats, so far from the abandoned, sinking Saraband, so far from the warmth of Cuba and San Antonio de los Baños, where a storm meant only that the coffee blossoms would smell sweeter at its end. Father clings to the gunwales and bears the waves that hammer the bow in endless and terrible succession, while she crouches in the decking at his feet, water welling at her wrists. Stung by brine, lashed with froth and the fluttering tails of his soaked nightshirt as he crouches lower and lower, crushed. Then all her breaths are water and she is drowning, though she hasn't met the sea. And rising to her knees, she clings to his bent waist and looks up. Father's face is turned, his mouth hisses rain and her mother's name one last time before they are borne upward, spun, and he shoves her down beneath the thwart and a wave slashes from starboard and sweeps her father so cleanly away she might have never had one.
I hope you do all your audiobooks.
Thank you so much.
Oh, God. I love that passage.
It's my favorite. Oh. My favorite part of the book.
Well, I'm curious to know how you paint this picture of New Orleans that no one else has ever quite managed before. How has this changed the way you see the city when you walk around now?
Well, New Orleans has always been in my imagination. I was born in New Orleans in my first 5 years or so on the North Shore, but really grew up in Florida, in Pensacola. That's why I always say Gulf Coast in the bios and stuff. But as Carlos Fuentes, the great Mexican novelist, but was born abroad, grew up outside of Mexico, said he always had the Mexico of his imagination. And New Orleans has always been a dream space for me.
Yeah.
So as a kid, and you'd always go back and visit family and things like that, but was always inventing the spaces of the city in my mind. And so really finally moving back within proximity and being able to explore and then being able to explore this other New Orleans, the New Orleans of the Civil War, yeah, it certainly changed my perceptions, but some of my perceptions, the story hewed to mine, but my mother-in-law came down to visit us, right, from Massachusetts. And so I took her on a tour. We did the whole thing. But my tour is sort of stops at about 1870. It's like, I'll tell you, okay, well, this is where this happened and this is where that happened. But now when I go through, I see that New Orleans a lot.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And there's much beauty and then there's quite a lot of ugliness too. It's just as important to know for me when I walk down the street to know that there was a slave market there. Or that there was American chess champion lived on Royal Street in 1861. Yeah. You know, something as bizarre as that.
Well, nobody will ever see New Orleans the same way again after this book.
Wow.
It's really
Thank
an
you
amazing
so much.
Thing. We've been talking with Kent Wascom, whose brilliant new novel is Secessia. You can meet him Tuesday, July 7th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. And that event benefits Press Street and Room 220. Thanks so much, Kent.
Thank you, Susan.
Robert S. Brantley is a photographer whose work in architecture and interior design photography has appeared in countless magazines and wonderful books. He's been documenting the architecture of Louisiana specifically since he moved here in 1977. His most recent project is a gorgeous architectural study called Henry Howard, Louisiana's Architect, with Victor McGee, published by the Historic New Orleans Collection and with photographs by Robert Brantley and Jan White Brantley. Robert, what a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks a lot.
This is such a gorgeous book. You must be so proud.
Yeah, we are very proud. It is beyond my wildest expectations. I mean, it is just gorgeous, everything about it.
Now, I think one of the first things that New Orleanians will notice when they look at this book is that everyone will recognize something. Some great building, the Pontalba Buildings, Maidwood Plantation, or Nottoway, or St. Peter and Paul Churches, some gorgeous house on St. Charles Avenue. And it really makes you see that Howard left his fingerprints all over the city.
He did.
So what were the fun spaces for you to photograph? Did you prefer the public spaces or the private homes? Or
I enjoyed the private homes. I think Jan would say the same because every one of them was so unique. There were no two alike. And the staircases were incredible. The wide open spaces of like the short house. That house was meant to have parties in it constantly. It has this gigantic hallway. And then to the left is a double parlor. And when you throw open all the doors, it's like one giant pavilion.
Wow. And you talk a lot about one distinguishing characteristic of his architecture were his fabulous staircases. So was that particularly hard at that time? Was that something you just grew to love?
The staircase in Ireland, the Irish country home, is usually set off to the side or encased in a room of its own. It is an architectural element to be appreciated solo.
Mm-hmm.
And when he had enough money, he did that. But a lot of the houses, you have the straight staircase that goes from the first to the second floor. His handrail would be indented severely so that you could hold on to it. And in some houses, the risers are not as high as the others. So ascending the staircase is almost like floating up it.
Oh, how nice. How interesting.
When he had the money, like at Belgrove or the Cock House or a few others, he put in a spiral staircase that would just take your breath away. Mm-hmm. And it was offset all by itself. So you would look into this room, and there's this magnificent spiral going up in all of its little glory.
And I think of how many brides I've seen come down that staircase at Maidwood.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's one of the famous staircases in Louisiana, for example.
It's gorgeous.
Now, you set out to give Henry Howard his proper due because you felt that his work hadn't been properly recognized along with some other architects. So I wonder if you talk just a bit about his architectural context.
That's a difficult question because he worked in every kind of different genre you can imagine. And he would take a Greek Revival element that he had done at Maidwood and then plunk it into a house in 1869, mm-hmm. you know, all those years later when it was had completely fallen out of favor. And he never followed trends. He used them, but he never followed them. His earliest work before we began this, everyone thought was Maidwood, 1846.
Right.
So when Victor and I started doing all the research, we backed it up to 1843 and started doing the building contract research and newspaper research at that date. And it was in the early part of 1844 when I found the first building contract.
Wow. So what was your collaboration with Victor McGee like? Because he was a direct descendant of Henry Howard. So what did that add to this project for you, working with him?
It was wonderful. Victor was like a brother to me, and like he was one of my closest and best friends I've ever had in my life. He was the great-great-great-grandson of Henry Howard. He was absolutely devoted to him, and he wanted people to know the extent of Howard's work. Mm-hmm. He discovered the first evidence of Henry Howard papers in an attic in the house he was growing up in, which was Seven Oaks Plantation.
Wow.
And he showed those to Sam Wilson within a year, and it just took off from there. That was in 1947. But he went off to Notre Dame, graduated. He entered the Brothers of Holy Cross. He ended up teaching in Miami, the University of Monterrey in Mexico. He taught in Cuba. He was in a small little village teaching there when Che Guevara and Castro rolled into town.
So he told you some great stories along the way.
Once he left the order and came back to New Orleans to teach, there were friends of his that he tried to get to do a thesis or a dissertation on Henry Howard or anything. And everyone threw up their hands in despair because Henry Howard, and as I'm discovering about James Gallier, kept themselves out of every public record they possibly could keep.
Wow.
Henry has no birth certificate, no death certificate. It's amazing. There is a naturalization in 1854. When he started the process, he didn't sign it until 1865.
Wow.
He's just not there. I mean, it's very difficult with Henry.
That's one of the things that fascinates me about a work like this, because you have such a keen visual sense of what you're doing. And Victor brought that need for scholarship and the paper chase, mm-hmm. the great paper chase. So you really had to comb through archives for information about the people who commissioned his work. And there's still a lot left to learn, isn't there? Isn't there one big group of papers missing?
There's a huge group missing. We've got 568 drawings, 50 sets of specifications that were sold in 1881. All of the office papers, the ledgers, the journals, the letters to his clients, the letters from the clients to him, all that's gone. Hopefully the book will uncover some drawings or some other details. Victor had found a large amount of material when I met him, and this book would not exist without Victor. Mm-hmm. Without his incredible drive to do this.
Drive and patience.
Yes.
It takes a lot of patience to do that.
When we first met in 1977, within a few months, he was touring me around the Garden District at different places and showing me not just Henry Howard's work, but he was showing me Gallier. He was showing me Charles Lewis Hilger or Lewis Ethan Reynolds. I mean, Victor was, he loved Henry Howard, but he had a great respect for everybody else. And he always wanted to know what is the relationship between Howard and the rest of these other architects, because an architect doesn't practice in a vacuum.
Right.
You know, he's got his friends. And I discovered that Henry Howard and James Gallier Jr. were friends. And I loved that.
Of course.
But Victor, he had told me about the frustration of it all because he had not been able to do it and no one else would take it up. And I said, well, let's give me a shot. So I quit work And I took 7 months and went to the Notarial Archives to do research in the public library. I worked there. I worked anywhere I could think of. And I quit when I ran out of money. And we didn't really have enough to finish that book at that time, but we decided that we had to put something down on paper with what we knew at the time while it was still fresh. And so Victor wrote the first draft. He would write, and I would be in the dark room, and I would be printing the photographs that we would write from the next night.
Oh, what a lovely process.
And it took 3 weeks. It was exhausting.
Yeah. But it's always enlightening, I think, to see New Orleans through the eyes of someone who is obsessed with a certain aspect of the city. And that's what you did. Did it change you in any way? Did it change your appreciation of the architecture or your own work, for example, to do this?
In essence, the work on Henry Howard completely changed my life. You know, I was doing architectural photography before, but not to a great extent. After working on Howard and seeing the other architectural jewels that this city has, which is thousands of them, I only wanted to photograph buildings. I wasn't interested in portraits or sports or anything like that. I wanted to show these houses and the commercial buildings. It was a delight, really, to photograph. I photographed an incredible amount of buildings that has nothing to do with Henry Howard.
Once you start, it's hard to stop, right?
It is.
Well, this book is so fabulous. It's so much more than a collection of photographs. It's such a labor of love, and it belongs on everybody's coffee table. We've been talking with Robert S. Brantley, whose beautiful new book is Henry Howard, Louisiana's Architect. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Margaret Fuller, A New American Life, Tuesday, July 7th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Today's guest, Kent Wascom, discusses and signs Secessia, Tuesday, July 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. This event benefits Press Street and Room 220. Rachel Emanuel, Ruby Jean Sims, and Charles Vincent will do a reading from Scotlandville, Tuesday, July 7th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. And starting this week and running through the entire month of July, the hunt for the popular children's book character Waldo is on again through Uptown New Orleans. Drop by Octavia Books to pick up a Find Waldo local passport in New Orleans and see how many Waldos you can find at various independent local shops. The first 100 Waldo seekers who get passports stamped at 10 or more sites can enter for prizes. And there'll be a special Waldo party Friday, July 31st at 5:30 at Octavia Books. Also, mark your calendar for these upcoming events. July 2nd through 5th is the annual Essence Festival. Check out essence.com for the full lineup of musical and literary guests. Some of the writers who'll be on hand include Charles Blow, author of A Fire Shut Up in My Bones, Donna Brazile, author of Cooking with Grease, Alice Randall, author of The Wind Ungone, appearing with her daughter and co-author Catherine Randall Williams of Soul Food Love. Also, Yana Van Zandt. And Tales of the Cocktail will be along July 15th through 19th with a host of mixologists and cocktail creators and historians in town. Check out totc.com for more information. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.